Welcome, and thanks for listening to Intrinsic Investigations. My name is Mr. Olivo, and I created this podcast because I've been fortunate enough over the last decade to see unique and thought-provoking projects happen in my classroom, and we wanted a place to showcase them. The true heart of this podcast lies not in the content discovered, but in exploring the personal stories of these young researchers as they journey through uncharted and unfamiliar intellectual terrain. By sharing their stories, we hope to normalize the challenges and frustrations that come with independent research, and also share those moments where students transcend the normal grind of the school day to discover concepts that range from the global to deeply personal. We will begin with a brief introduction to the student of focus, why they pick their topic, and discuss their growth over the course of the last year. It should be mentioned that the opinions expressed in this podcast in no way reflect the opinions of our school district, Bergen County Technical Schools and Special Services, or our school itself, Bergen County Technical High School Teterboro, or the College Board. The work detailed in this podcast was most likely completed in AP Capstone, but this podcast is in no way affiliated with the College Board. For this episode, we have three guests, and this has never happened before, and they're all laughing about this fact. There you go. We got Jamila right away. So we have Jamila, Tanvi, and Rachel. The reason why we have three guests is because all three of these guests did the same exact method, which is not a method that high school students typically do. Jamila, you have the mic right now. What is that method?
We did a meta-analysis.
Yeah. So before we try to understand what a meta-analysis is and how each of you employed it in very unique ways, it probably makes sense to understand who you are, who the three of you are. So if you could just introduce your name, if you want to do your name, your grade, your major, and what you find particularly interesting other than cannibalism, Jamila, which we'll get into in a little bit, we could start right away.
Okay, hello everyone. My name is Jamil Shin, and I'm currently a junior in commercial art.
Hi, my name is Tanvi, and I'm a junior in culinary.
Hi, my name is Rachel, and I'm a junior in strategic asset management.
Which I believe is changing names next year.
To what?
Oh, I'm not going to get into that in the podcast. Oh, no. All right. So now that I just blew Rachel's mind, but Jamila, what are you interested in outside of school?
I'm actually trying to pursue a major in conservational biology. So in the future, I would like to work with wildlife.
Oh, wow. And you're a very good artist.
Thank
likewise.
You.
Yeah.
In terms of major, I want to go into genetics or genetic engineering. And like non-academically, I like baking a lot, ice skating.
All right. That was Tanvi.
I'm a competitive dancer outside of school.
All right. Yep. Yeah, all right. So Rachel's a competitive dancer, Tanvi can bake, and Jamila wants to be a conservational biologist. Are all of you interested in the biological sciences?
I am. I know Tanvi is.
Rachel, what about you?
Yeah.
Yeah? Maybe not. And that's fine. You don't have to have your mind made up at this point. All right, let's get right into what your work was about. And we'll start with Jamila.
Oh, okay.
Before we go into what the work was about, let's just talk what the method is. So the three of you each did a meta-analysis. What, Jamila, how would you define a meta-analysis for a high school student who's never done a meta-analysis? What is it?
I think the definition that made me understand what a meta-analysis was basically taking other people's studies and their data and kind of conjoining them together to get your own full data. Like overall, I know all of us worked with effect size specifically. So I would say going into multiple sources, which could be like 10 or more, and taking all of their data, finding like an effect size and seeing how that relates to our own data.
All right. Anything that Tanvi or Rachel would like to add to that definition?
I would say that's a good definition. It's just essentially using data from other sources as your own data to find your own patterns and findings through it.
It sounds good to you, Rachel?
Amazing.
Okay. If someone were to say, oh, this doesn't sound like original research because you're just using the work of other people, how would you respond to that criticism?
Well, I would say I feel like a meta-analysis is a bit original. Like, I would say a meta-analysis is original because even though you are taking data from other sources, a meta-analysis has like a greater generalizability compared to other studies, and you're taking all of these sources and trying to find a common pattern between them, which I feel like is also similar to other methods, like kind of like a content analysis, where you're just trying to look for a pattern. And yeah, I would say that's what I think.
I agree. I think although you are using data from other people's work, you're essentially creating your own connections between them, which in a way is original research because you're creating new findings. So,
But also in my own research, I also found that with like the comparison among sources, I found my own conclusions that were really different from other resources. So in that way, it's still original.
Yeah, and I just was asking the question because when people hear the method for the first time, sometimes they have this misconception that you're just looking at other people's sources and you're like, oh, okay, they say that this thing is correlated with this thing and I'm just looking at patterns in those. But I know from working with the three of you that you used a large amount of statistics, statistical analysis software. Which one of you used Cochrane RevMan?
I was the one who used Cochrane RevMan.
And then programming in R.
I did that as well.
Yeah, or other ways of creating funnel plots or looking for heterogeneity. Like there's a lot of math involved in this. And I'm just curious, are any of the three of you into statistics? Or was this your first real exposure to statistics?
In my opinion, I was actually really scared. I don't know if you remember this conversation, Mr. Olivo, but it was when my research was first getting approved and you suggested that I should change to a meta-analysis because originally I was going to do a content analysis. And I kept trying to ask you if I couldn't do a meta-analysis.
I think I recall this.
Yes, yeah. I was trying to find an alternative way to do my research, and I was really scared. And then you asked me, Jamila, do you think anybody here knows what they're doing? And that gave me the courage to try it out.
Because you don't until you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's I don't know. Any other thoughts on that one? Or any stats fans out of the three of you? That was a head shake no from Tommy. You just can't see because of the medium we're discussing in right now. But
way back in September, my research project was actually entirely different. Actually, the summer before this year, I remember I went out with Jamila and she asked me if I knew what I wanted to do with AP research. And I said that I was thinking of doing like a genetics project, but what was steering me away was like the whole math aspect of it. And because of that, in September, my research project was like designing a new technology relating to medicine. But then I ended up switching back to a meta-analysis, but essentially what like drove me away from doing the meta-analysis in the first place was like all the math that was involved.
I recall that being your original idea.
For me personally, when I first decided to do a meta-analysis, I like oversimplified the idea of it, and then once I actually had to do all the calculations, I realized it was a lot more work than I thought it would be, because then it's not just one equation that I have to use, but then you have to use multiple different statistics to like back each one up like again and again.
And all that work that you put in, is it worth it in terms of the new understandings that you were able to find? We'll get into those new understandings, but just to Rachel's point, like you initially look at it and you're looking at like your PRISMA inclusion and exclusion criteria, and then you get down into the numbers, is it worth it in the end based on what you were able to find in your projects?
I think yes, because if I were to do the kind of research I did in like a lab setting, it would have taken a really long time and it would have been very complicated. But I essentially found whatever I found through just using other people's data, and the statistics that I found, I'll talk more about this later, I guess,
yeah,
when
sure.
I go into my research. But I kept finding more and more gaps the more research I did, and the actual numbers is what kind of started closing those gaps for me. So I think it was worth it in the end.
Great.
I think it was very worth it because I remember my original idea with the content analysis. I feel like if I ended up not doing a meta-analysis and going with the content analysis instead, I don't think I would be as interested in my topic or as confident as I am in my study.
I would also say it was worth it just because, as I mentioned before, that through this, I learned a lot of new conclusions and perspectives that a bunch of other sources, they didn't really touch upon. And it was only because I used a meta-analysis and I was able to go through the different effect sizes and even with heterogeneity, which I guess we'll go into later, but it just really helped me understand how, well, my topic was about parent and teen relationships, but it just opened up multiple views, points that weren't touched upon yet.
Yeah, this is a good segue into the topics. I think something worth pointing out before the topics is that the three of you are all juniors in high school. Tanvi wanted to do something involving genetics, but our lab facilities probably didn't have what you wanted to do at this point. We just didn't have anything that would allow. And it's just as you go into higher education, you keep that same level of ambition, you will have those opportunities. Jamila, you probably didn't have access to dead baby mice, which we will talk about why that's so crucial to your work in a moment. And Rachel, to look at psychological studies involving parent and teen dynamics, probably would have acquired some pretty heavy IRB approvals that you may not have even been guaranteed access to. So it seems like using secondary data versus the primary data that is typically associated with science, I think incorrectly, like sometimes there are scientific discoveries made using secondary data that are just as important as primary data. But I think that enabled you to explore your topics of interest. So on that note, Jamila, what was the topic that you explored with a meta-analysis?
So what I did was I did a study exploring the relationship between the provision of nesting materials and pup mortality in C57BL/6 laboratory mice.
And Tanvi?
I essentially looked at how a mutation in a very specific area of the TP53 gene affected clinical outcomes within patients that had sporadic cancer versus cancer that was more genetically inherited.
Okay. And Rachel?
I did a study between the parent and teen relationship and how communication specifically affected the parent's mental health.
Okay. So for the sake of the audience being able to follow along, I'm going to ask each one of you a series of questions now that those topics are done, and we'll pass the mic that way. Jamila, why did you explore these nesting materials and these mice?
So I actually have two main reasons. So firstly, I did come across this topic by coincidence because originally I was going to research the psychology behind cannibalism in human beings since I was interested in the topic of psychology prior to taking this class. But after searching up the keyword cannibalism on Google Scholar, I did end up finding a different source that was talking about cannibalistic behaviors in laboratory mice. And by reading that source, I was able to gain insight on how pup mortality has been a very common issue among specifically C57BL/6 laboratory mice. And I did think, well, this is a problem that I should probably explore and find a way if there's a way to reduce pup mortality. And I guess the second bigger reason for taking on this topic was because I care about animals in general. And I feel like when people think about animal experimentation, they mostly think about rabbits or cats and dogs. And I feel like that's mostly because people have a greater emotional response to those animals. And I feel like mice are kind of overlooked in that sense, because even though they're the most widely used, people don't talk about them as much, which is also why I wanted to explore this.
When you say talk about them, do you mean talk about them in the context of ensuring ethical treatment of them?
Yeah, I was definitely thinking about the ethics of it, definitely caring for them and giving them a better housing, giving them better housing conditions, because I know that a lot of laboratory mice still to this day are put into very horrible conditions, like shoe boxes, and it's just not great.
Even in a lab, they're put in shoe boxes?
Yeah, I have seen pictures of studies where these mice were put in actual shoe boxes with no enrichment whatsoever. And so that's also another reason why I wanted to do this topic.
What did you end up finding out in doing your meta-analysis about the relationship between nesting materials and these mice pups that correct me if I'm wrong, will eventually be used for experimentation.
Yeah. So my main findings were basically that the by providing nesting materials, pup mortality was reduced, and these mice did end up having a higher chance of survival when given these nesting materials.
You want to talk about any specific pieces of data that,
led
to that?
Yeah, so just to give more context on nesting materials, so nesting materials, they serve the function of providing a source of warmth for these mice, and many of these pups, they are born without fur, and they lack their own thermoregulatory abilities, meaning that they're not able to keep themselves warm, and so oftentimes they do have to rely on their mothers, and that's not a very... that's not a very good thing, because most of the time, these C57BL/6 mice, the mothers were known to be neglectful at times. And so because of that, many of these pups die from hypothermia. And so the hypothesis of my study was that providing nesting materials would give them a sense of warmth and prevent hypothermia, which would then increase their chances of survival. And so the data that I did find with my meta-analysis was that I had studies that were randomized controlled studies. So they had an experimental group and a control group. And the experimental group was given nesting materials while the control group wasn't. And just from finding the effect sizes of all those studies and finding the overall effect size, it did show that the experimental group did have a higher chance of survival.
So in the end, what should laboratories take away based on the work that you examined?
Definitely to provide more enrichment, because I know that some laboratories, they still don't provide nesting materials, because technically in the animal ethics rules, it doesn't explicitly state that mice have to be given nesting materials, but from what my study shows, I feel like it should definitely be necessary.
All right. Who would like to go next, Rachel or Tanvi? Because I'm asking similar questions to...
You'll go?
Yeah. Okay. All right. You could probably take the mic, Tanvi. There you go. All right. So Tanvi, just same idea here. What did you end up discovering in examining the genes of interest, and I guess like the bigger consequences of what was discovered with this meta-analysis?
So essentially, to give some background, what kind of inspired me to choose my specific research question was. There was one study I found by Cato et al. That essentially looked at 25 patients that had genetically inherited cancer, and the cancer that I was looking at is called adrenocortical carcinoma, and 25 cases of completely sporadic cancer versus 25 genetically inherited. And within the 25 that were genetically inherited, there was a lot of variation between how long the patients live, with some passing away in childhood and some living well past 50, and also between how often the disease recurred versus how well the treatment actually like worked in terms of getting rid of the disease. Whereas with the sporadic ACC, there was a lot less variation in terms of clinical outcomes. And so I wanted to look at what specifically was causing this discrepancy between the two. And so I found that when looking at, so there's one area of the TP53 gene called residue 337. And in patients that don't have this cancer whatsoever, this residue is made up primarily of the amino acid histidine. But with patients that had LFS, this histidine was morphed into arginine. And so what I found that is that this change from histidine to arginine doesn't exhibit itself the same way in various patients, as some people had worse survival outcomes in terms of disease recurrence and earlier death, whereas for others, this switch between histidine and arginine didn't show itself at all. So either the treatment completely worked on them, or they just lived as if they'd never really had symptoms. And the reason for this was because everyone's tumor microenvironments is different, and so the way that the shift in amino acids would exhibit itself is different from each patient. So that's probably my biggest finding.
I think I need to give some context here. You are a junior at a high school where you do not take biology until your junior year. So how did you navigate the biological complexity of what it is you were trying to research, while at the same time you hadn't finished a high school biology course yet? How did you deal with that?
I took a lot of help from my biology teacher, Ms. Michaels.
Oh, okay.
At the beginning of the year, when I first started the project, I told her I wanted to go into genetics, but I was very uneducated on the subject. And so after this class, I went to her because I have lunch next. And we sat for almost like an hour straight. And she was just talking to me about genetics. And in my presentation, I have like a diagram kind of that I made, or like a model of how different genes worked. And that diagram was like, I made that back in September or back in October when I was talking to Ms. Michaels about it. And I was seeing her like at least three times a week, either during my class or during lunch, just to talk to her about everything. And she helped me a lot through this process. And I also had an expert advisor who helped me a lot. And over spring break, I actually went to his labs and we were kind of looking at my work and kind of just talking about it. So I think the help from my advisors, if it wasn't for them, then I wouldn't have been able to do what I did.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you had multiple levels of mentorship that you were constantly utilizing. So more power to you. All right, we're going to pass the mic on down to Rachel. And Rachel, what did you try to explore, and what did you find as well?
So as I said before, I was exploring how the communication levels between a parenting relationship affected the parent's mental health, because when I initially started looking into this topic, I noticed a pattern between all these sources that they only focused on the child's mental health and how the relationship only impacted them. But through my research, I really wanted to focus on how the parents were affected, because it's commonly overlooked, as many researchers tend to categorize parents as, because they're older of age, that their mentality, they wouldn't really change over time. But through my research, I was actually able to find that the parents' mental health is is impacted a lot, and specifically between the quality of the relationship and communication levels, I was able to find that it's really important to prioritize the quality of the communication rather than the quantity of how much you communicate, just because if you look at it in terms of like nagging or arguing, it can actually have a negative impact, which one would, this seems very obvious, but this perspective was overlooked a lot by other researchers, and it wasn't dived into a lot, even though this might seem like an obvious result. But through my research, it just opens it up for other sources to be able to analyze this too.
How are you defining quality of communication? Because like nagging is like, would nagging be like, Rachel, did you do your homework? Rachel, did you do your homework? Rachel, like that. I'm assuming that's nagging.
Yes.
But like, what are more positive qualities of communication? Did any of the sources get into that, where you could give an example?
Not really, because these categories, I got them across multiple sources. There is obviously a bunch of variations between these variables, so that's why I had to code them in order to make these categories between parental well-being, communication, and quality. But then within that, there are also so many different variations. Like, for example, in parental well-being, some sources, they would measure it based on the parental flourish, but then in other sources, it would be based on parental depression. And because of these differences, that's also what caused a high heterogeneity.
For fans of the more technical aspects of meta-analyses, Rachel is trying to get published right now. Are any of you? Tanvi and Jamil, they're all trying to get published right now. So if you want to dig deeper into heterogeneity and things like that, their work will hopefully be out there soon. But thank you to each of you for that general overview of your findings. We only have a little bit of time left, and we have three people, so we definitely want your perspectives on a little bit of self-reflection at the end of this. What would you say was the most difficult thing in doing a project like this, and how did you overcome it? Whoever wants to jump in first.
I'll start us off.
All right, Rachel's going to start us
off. So I think the most difficult thing was that doing a meta-analysis was very tedious, just because of all the calculations that you had to do. And it requires a lot of time management, because I decided to do it manually through all my coding and everything. So it required, I had to make a strict schedule for myself to be able to keep on track of everything. And it's just important to take that into consideration because of the time constraint when you're taking AP research. And you just have to be able to manage your time properly. But I'm not trying to stray people away from doing a meta-analysis. I genuinely learned so much doing this method. And I think it's important for other people to also learn how to use these calculations, because they do explore really unique ideas that can help answer a lot of questions.
And before Jamila responds, I do have to point out that Rachel has had a beautiful visual representation as to how to manage her time. I just want to give you credit for that. It was like an hour. Was it like an hourglass? It was next level. Just take my word for it. Aww. All right. Thank you, Rachel. So Jamila, most challenging thing. How did you deal with it?
I was definitely intimidated by doing a meta-analysis because I knew that it required, it doesn't require, but you definitely needed to use certain programs to help you with all of the calculations. And I was really intimidated by this at first, so much so that I tried to do calculations manually for the effect sizes, which was not a good idea because in the end, that just took away more time than just figuring out how to use a statistical program. So I knew that Mr. Levo couldn't really help me learn how to use these programs. I don't know if you've ever used them before.
Nah.
Yeah.
Oh, I've tried using R, but it was just I was trying to use R for fun. And then I quickly realized I needed a reason to use R to keep me motivated to using it. Cause it was like one month I had more free time than usual. I was like, oh yeah, like let me learn how to use the standard statistical software that's out there right now. And then I was like, no.
Yeah. So I was definitely intimidated to try those out. And I also didn't have an expert advisor, so I couldn't really rely on someone to help teach me these things. But I kind of realized that I was kind of missing the point. I was relying too much on others to teach me how to do stuff, especially with the meta-analysis. And so I realized that I should just do it myself. So I did seek out that, because both of these programs, they had like help manuals. And so I read through those to help me out. And I also...
You read the manual?
I read the manuals.
Wow, that's it.
Yes, I read the handbook.
If you're going to go it alone, you got to read the manual.
Yeah, I read the Cochrane Handbook for Systematic Reviews and Literature. I also watch YouTube tutorials, a lot of YouTube tutorials to help me out. And in the end, I did learn how to use these, and I think that was a valuable skill to learn. So,
if you can learn how to read a manual and put it into practice, that is an important skill. I just think of... how many people, like, we have these things that have manuals associated with them. How much time do people really spend to try to understand how things work? So, all right, if you got the Cochrane RevMan manual and you figured it out, more power to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
No problem. All right, Tanvi, most challenging thing, and how did you deal with it?
I think first was, like Jamila said, just the programming. I use 3D modeling softwares to kind of visualize the mutations I was looking at. And there were just so many issues with it. Like at the beginning of the year, my laptop couldn't like handle the softwares and it would keep crashing every
Sounds
time
like
I tried
problem.
Doing it. So that wasn't working out. And then after I got my new laptop, the data wasn't transferring right. And I had to like restart inputting all of the data that I'd collected. And it was just, that was a huge issue. But again, like similar to Jamila, I watched a lot of YouTube videos and I figured it out eventually. And I think another challenge was just reaching out to people, because all throughout Capstone, something that I really struggled with was like speaking during discussions and presenting and just putting myself out there. But at the beginning of this project, I knew that I would need help from other people to figure out what I was doing. So just reaching out to my expert advisor and to Ms. Michaels and just like taking help from other people, I think was one of the biggest challenges I faced.
The bell is about to ring. Did you have any fun doing a meta-analysis?
Yes.
Oh. I had the best time of my life. This
oh,
was my
wow.
favorite.
Okay.
This was like one of my favorite classes this year. I love my topic so much.
It's great.
I had a great time. I learned so much, and I'm so grateful for the experience.
Oh, all right. It just sounded like you were just, I tried flipping the script because you were talking about your challenges, but I guess you grew from it. So there's value right there. All right. Thank you all so much. And enjoy your weekend because it's Friday. It's
thank
Friday
you.
Here in podcast land. And the bell's about to ring in 3 seconds.
Have a great weekend, Mr. Levo.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good
Thank you.
Awesome.
Woo.
All right.